Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Mickey Mantle, Sandy Koufax, two heroic symbols of the boomer generation, two flawed figures, one of his own accord, one of just poor luck. Jane Levy has turned both of their stories into best-selling biographies. So what does she do for an encore? Why not another icon, one who wrestled with his own demons, although it didn't seem to bother his play on the field too much? Yes, Levy, who also served as guest editor for the 2011 edition of the Best American Sports Writing Series, has taken on the challenge of another project about Babe Ruth. How will this one be different from such estimable books by Robert Creamer, Lee Montville, and a host of others? What can she offer that others haven't? That was the crux of our recent conversation.
Jane Levy, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Mickey Mantle, Sandy Koufax, and now Babe Ruth. I mean, you don't think small at all, do you, when it comes to your topics or biographies?
You know, Babe Ruth pretty much eliminated small ball from baseball. I think he took me with him. It has as much to do, honestly, with timing and publishing and what publishers want as it has to do with interests of mine. I mean, there are plenty of things I would have been happy to write about other than another iconic baseball player. But when you have a publisher that keeps saying, oh, gee, can't you dig up another, you know, New York superstar who, you know, that you can find new things out about, you know, that's what you do.
So that must be hard because there has been so much written about Ruth that you wonder what's left. I mean, there are books about how he transformed baseball in the shadow of the Black Sox scandal. There's his personal life. There's this. There's that. So what are you focusing on in this book?
You know, it gave me, and to a certain extent still does, give me trepidation for exactly that reason. It's not exactly like they were lightweights who've written about him, you know, most notably Bob Creamer, who did the first major biography, which was published in 74, and then, you know, Lee, and he did a really good job, too. So I come to it with humbly, to say the least. What I decided to do, and I think this is an aspect of his career that has not been, it's been touched on but not perhaps in depth, is the way in which he came to prominence at exactly a moment in history where all the mechanisms and technology for a new kind of fame, a new American fame, were coalescing. So the industry of public relations, the industry of marketing, promotion, even product placement, was all coming together in the early 20s around the two fathers of public relations, Ivy Lee and Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays being Sigmund Freud's nephew, who borrowed Uncle Siggy's notions about unconscious desires and transferred them to what was then called the new consumerism, to find ways to basically manipulate people to spend this newly disposable income on things they didn't know they wanted until he got done showing them that they really did need and want them. And along comes Ruth at exactly this moment with a personality and a voice and a platform that was unprecedented in American, not just in baseball, but really in sports. Yes, Ty Cobb had done advertising. Yes, Bill Tilden did some things until people found out that he wasn't necessarily someone you wanted to promote, and so did Jack Dempsey. But really, Babe was the first modern athlete in athlete celebrity, and he became a template, I think, for how to be famous in America. And he did this with the assistance of his agent, Christy Walsh, who was kind of like a Irish Catholic Sammy Glick. He was an energizer bunny in the world of advertising and promotion. And he was a California kid, failed cartoonist, failed ad man, who came east just as Bernays and Ivy Lee were redefining and creating modes of public relations. And I spent actually a fair amount of time trying to see whether there was a literal connection between them, not just one of osmosis. And I finally found one, but not till later in their careers. But here he is in New York, and he looks around, and he gets the great idea, and actually uses the words, you know, here was a gift from the gods to exploit, referring to Babe Ruth. He later wrote, after he closed his business, a self-published book called Adios Ghosts, in which he revealed, but being a PR man, you never know exactly how much of it was exaggeration, how he went about creating this Christy Walsh syndicate. But according to him, he talked his way into Ruth's apartment one day, posing as a beer delivery guy, when the beer delivery guy down the block at the deli that Ruth favored didn't show up for work. I've heard other versions of it that are more tantalizing than that, but either which way, he basically talked his way in and said, how much did you get for that article that you wrote under your name? You know, and I think Ruth said $500 or something like that. And he said, well, I can get you $1,000. He wrote a check for $1,000, even though he didn't have $1,000. And he signed him to a contract to become his ghost. And ghostwriting became a hugely prominent business. And he represented everyone from Walter Johnson, John McGraw, to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, but Babe was the beginning and the end. And so what he started as was a syndicating columns written under players' names by the same reporters who, of course, were covering the Babe and Lou and everybody else by day. So you had this really strange collusion where these guys were writing as Babe Ruth and then writing about Babe Ruth or Lou or John McGraw or whoever. And it became a fairly big business, but it quickly spread out to be more than just ghostwriting. Product promotion, radio appearances, vaudeville, you name it. And all of it was made possible because of the invention and the availability of teletype and phones and the ability to send copy back to New York through wires meant that New York papers had more reason to send reporters farther afield to cover him. So it was a golden age of sports. It was the golden age of sports writing. It was the golden age of ghostwriting. And so my way of going about this is to look at Babe as a template for a new kind of way to be famous. And so the book is called, actually, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the Advent of Celebrity.
And who's the publisher?
It is HarperCollins, publisher of The Mantle and Koufax Books.
Now, this is still a work in progress. When do you anticipate release of the book? Was that a sore spot?
Let's just say I have a long leash on this one. It's actually, I'm finding it daunting, and maybe some of the people who might be kind enough to listen to this might be able to help out, because what I've decided to do is use the 1927 barnstorming tour that Ruth and Gehrig alighted on right after they swept the Pirates, right after Babe Ruth hit the 60th home run, and Christy Walsh organized this tour for them for 21 cities. right after the last game of the series. And in fact, because they, nobody knew that it was going to go in four straight, he had to scurry and add dates to this. So they started in Providence and then immediately went to Trenton and then back to Brooklyn, though it was really Queens, and then to Asbury Park. And from Asbury Park, they set out across the country to Lima, Ohio, through Chicago to stop and have dinner with some of Christy Walsh's other clients, including and friends, including Marion Davies and Newt Rockne, down to Kansas City, back up to the Midwest to Omaha, Des Moines, Sioux City, Denver, across the Rockies, and then all the way down the California coast. And so that's going to provide the structure for telling the story about Babe at the apogee of fame. And needless to say, there aren't a whole lot of people left alive who are in a position to share stories about this. But there are people who turn out to have film and movies and photos in the attic, or stories just that they've stored away that their mom, dad, father, brother, uncle told them about the day Babe Ruth came to town, the day they snuck into the ballpark in Trenton or Asbury Park. And I'm busy ferreting out those kinds of stories from anyone and everyone who can help. And, you know, I'm actually setting out to go to California to follow Babe's trip there. Not being entirely stupid, I just figured I'd do Des Moines in the spring. So I'm starting in L.A., which is actually where they finished. He finished at Wrigley Field, batting against Charlie Root, who, of course, would have been famous later for the 1932 called shot. But I found in San Francisco the oldest living Yankee, guy who played, I don't know, I should look this up, I don't know, a handful of games, Rugger Artozoa. And who played for the Yankees in 1947 and happened to be on the field in the dugout on Babe Ruth Day in 1947, the first of the two Babe Ruth Days, the second being in June 13th, 1948, the one where Nat Fine took the famous picture of him in uniform leaning on a bat. But this was the Babe Ruth Day that was sanctioned by Major League Baseball, and he appeared in his great camel hair coat, which dwarfed him, and his hair was wispy and rotted from cancer and cancer treatments. And he had trouble, Rugger told me, getting up the dugout steps. And so Rugger happened to be there at exactly the right moment in history to lend Babe Ruth an arm. And Babe says what he said to everybody, "Thanks, kid." And that would have been enough, except that the story continues that in November, the following November, on his birthday, Rugger got a thank you note from Babe Ruth.
So it's
those kind of little stories. And Rugger went to one of the games on the tour, by the way, in 27.
And just for those who aren't familiar, barnstorming is when a group of ball players travels around the country taking on either local teams or college teams in the various towns. And this was a huge deal because before television, I mean, before even radio was used that much, this was the only way people would ever get to see a person of Ruth's stature.
Yes, absolutely. I should have explained that. Thank you for filling that in. Yeah, and in this case, the teams that played were called the Bustin' Babes and the Larrapin' Lou's. And for the most part, they were pickup games where Walsh would get some group of locals, you know, might be a company team, or it might be some minor leaguers or industrial league players, or former major leaguers, and with occasional cameos by guys like Lefty O'Doul and Alex Metzler, and you know, there was Walter the Great Males, and you know, all these names that, you know, who would materialize on the field to face the Babe and might have had an interaction with him in a major league game prior or later. But for the most part, they were just kind of pickup games. In Santa Barbara, for example, the USS Colorado was at dock there, was docking there, and so Babe played with the USS Colorado baseball team, who knew they had a baseball team. I guess it was they had a field. I don't know. And so, yeah, they were largely, you know, some of the games were better quality than others. In Northern California, they played a lot of games where a lot of the old San Francisco Seals and Oaks were available to play. So the quality of those games were actually pretty good. It was a circus. It was a caravan. It was Babe Ruth going out to the masses and taking a victory lap across the country at the absolute peak of his fame and popularity. And of course, you know, you're completely right. Nobody west of St. Louis would have seen a major league game prior to that. Nobody would have had an opportunity to see him. Yeah, they would show up in newsreels every once in a while. But even radio broadcasts were still pretty new. I mean, the October 27 World Series was the first one broadcast nationally. And the first baseball game was broadcast in October 22. So when you think of Babe Ruth, you're looking at somebody who came to the major leagues before the advent of radio and who died in August 1948, just as we were entering the television age. In fact, RCA, I found a picture of a television brought to his apartment so that he could watch baseball. And, of course, it was, you know, as with everything, it was a promotional tie-in. Sure, let's give the Babe, you know, a TV and get some good ink. But it does indicate the span of his lifetime and his career as a public person. To think about just how much had changed in that interim was astonishing. And you can look at Babe Ruth very much as, and I do, as a kind of revolutionary. I mean, by hiring Christy Walsh, who was the first sports agent, he was, perhaps not consciously, but he was asserting the right of a ball player to have representation and to make money, off the field. By insisting on his right to barnstorm, which of course he was suspended for and fined for by the estimable Commissioner Landis in 1922, he was asserting his right to make a living during the off season by playing against Negro League teams, which he did in both stops in New Jersey, Trenton, and Asbury Park. He was defying custom, if not, law, to say, yeah, I'll play against anybody. I don't care what color they are. And so I think of him as in many ways not just on the field. Of course, he completely revolutionized how the game is played, but he was really kind of radical off the field as well.
Now, you mentioned, and I'm glad you brought that up, his confrontation with Judge Landis. Why was Landis so against barnstorming? Was it just Ruth or barnstorming in general that he opposed?
Certainly Ruth was the main topic of conversation for Landis. I mean, there's a bylaw that existed that prohibited anybody who had played on a World Series team from playing non-sanctioned post-major league World Series season games for fear, according to this bylaw, that somebody would think you were somehow staging another World Series, which of course is insane. It's not like you were reconvening the 22 Yankees. I think it was typical short-sightedness of Major League Baseball and not realizing what he was doing for the game. I mean, he was creating a fan base in places they Major League Baseball couldn't be seen or heard in those years. And I think it was, again, it was an issue of power and control and who's going to be in charge, which, of course, you know, if you'd look at the historical line, it wasn't until Marvin Miller came along in 65 and took over the Players Association that the balance of power in baseball began to really change. But Babe Ruth tested all that. He did end up having to succumb to Landis, and he did get fined. I mean, he started his tour in the end of 21 and ended up, you know, having to quit the tour, and he wasn't allowed to play until May. He was suspended for 6 weeks of the first 6 weeks of the 22 season. But what did he do? He went and performed in vaudeville, where he made more money than he would have made on the field. And noticeably, he was photographed on opening day and at Griffith Stadium in Washington with the President of the United States. So what's the message? Landis wasn't photographed with the President of the United States. It was Babe Ruth all natted out in the presidential box. You know, so he was in every conceivable way asserting his rights, his power, you know, and his centrality. I actually found the part of the code that he violated. He was fined because he had violated Section 8B, Article 4 of the Major League Code, which stated that players from the two World Series teams were banned from participating in any other games due to the potential of restaging the World Series in another city. So much for that.
Now, you knew both of your other subjects. You knew Mantle. You knew Koufax personally. Obviously, you didn't know Ruth.
But I'm channeling him through a Ouija board.
I was going to say that's one way to do it. Is he being cooperative?
You know, part of the thing about Babe Ruth, and it is the biggest challenge here, is to find an authentic voice. Because, again, going back to Christy Walsh's ghostwriting enterprise, you had people putting words in Babe Ruth's mouth, literally, in copy, I mean. And you never know how much of what he said, either for quotation in the daily newspapers or under his own byline, he actually said. You know, there's a famous line where when I guess it was Bill Corum, I think. No, it was either Bill Corum or Bill Slocum. I should know the difference. Wrote something and he said, you know, he sounds more like me than I do. But you finding moments where his voice and actual thoughts and are human size is really, 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 really hard. I found one that I love, and there is always a bravado about him. He hit a home run, and he said, "Watch my dust," which I think is just great. And I found a story by a young guy that was actually published in Sport magazine after Ruth's death. This guy who later became an actual writer, won a high school contest in 1934, and he won the opportunity to come in the locker room. Jake Rupert, I guess, picked, or some henchman for Jake Rupert picked which high school kid wrote the best essay about why I want to meet the Babe. Jake Rupert, of course, being the owner of the Yankees back then. And this kid goes in the locker room and sits and shares a soda pop with the Babe, and he thinks he's like going to be a big journalist, and so he brings a pad of paper and he asks all these questions. And of course, the question of the day was, you know, about whether Babe Ruth was going to manage the Yankees or why he wasn't being allowed to manage the Yankees. And the famous trope is, well, he can't manage himself. How can he manage a baseball team? Well, so this kid, you know, trying to be all grown up, asking this question, and comes out of Babe Ruth, maybe because he was talking to a kid, this plaintive cri de coeur where he says, that's what's wrong with you guys. Of course, this kid was not one of those guys. You know, you can't let a fella change. I'm not, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm not that guy anymore. Why won't you give me a chance? Sure, I ran around. Sure, I did all that stuff. But I don't do that anymore. You know, why can't you see me as something other than this, you know, oversized, reckless, appetite-driven buffoon? And, of course, the reason they couldn't is because he was trapped inside an image that he willingly, happily collaborated on with all those sports writers and Christy Walsh. But there was in that moment, you know, just this hint of a real human voice. And later in that same interview, the kid asked him what it's like to be in the batter's box. And he talks about how lonely it is and how he doesn't really think about anything other than he thinks about everything else other than the ball until it's pitched, including, you know, whether the pork chops should have had more barbecue sauce or whether Claire likes the watch. Claire, his second wife, likes the watch she just bought her. And it's wonderful. And I suspect because the kid was a kid and maybe Ruth was unguarded and there certainly wasn't any intermediary there. But finding those moments, those voices, you know, those echoes, I should say, of his voice is very hard. And therefore, you know, I'm soliciting anybody who has a memory that is, you know, particular to them and their experience with him to get in touch and help me out.
And how should they go about doing that?
I would say they could email me at janelevy.com. JaneLevy.com.
So they should go to your website and they can contact you through that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Or they can go to that's www.janelevy.com, or my email address is jane.levy@icloud.com.
Very good. Well, Jane, it's been wonderful talking to you. I'm really looking forward to the book.
Don't hold your breath there, Ron.
Well, I'm sure it'll be just as fascinating as your previous books, and we're looking forward to it. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, Ron. Thank you for having me.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Jane Levy. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Ron Chandler, author of the 29th edition of Ron Chandler's Baseball Analyst. And we'll be talking about fantasy baseball and the new metrics that are so prevalent these days. Don't forget to visit the site, ronchandlersbaseballbookshelf.com, for the latest news, interviews, etc., etc., etc. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.
Had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand. He'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder.